Welcome back to another deep dive. Today, we're going to try and untangle something that I think actually I know is messing with all of our heads right now.
Oh, totally. It is the absolute water we swim in.
Yeah, you really can't get through a single conversation without it. We're talking about the chaos of comparison.
It's everywhere. We are constantly triangulating things just to get through the day.
Seriously. Like, think about the last meeting you were in.
Mm.
Or even just, you know, scrolling through social media. You see these takes like, this new crypto regulation is exactly like prohibition in the 1920s.
Right, or this tech CEO is the new Steve Jobs.
Exactly. Or even just something super mundane like, wow, this coffee tastes like mud. We navigate the unknown by pinning it to the known. This is like that.
And that is exactly where it gets dangerous. Because most of the time, we have absolutely no idea why we think one thing is like another. We rely on a vibe.
A vibe, yeah. We see a surface similarity, like maybe two founders are both wearing black turtlenecks and we just assume their business strategies must be identical.
Right. We confuse a vague hunch with a hard predictive fact. And when you build a strategy or a policy or even just a relationship on a hunch that you think is a law of nature, well, things collapse.
They fall apart completely. We are honestly just very bad at distinguishing between these things look alike and these things work alike.
Mm-hmm.
So today we are doing something really special. We're getting into a situated literature review that proposes an actual solution to this.
Yes. It introduces a comprehensive framework called the Hierarchy of Relational Claims.
Which I know sounds a bit academic. Hierarchy of Relational Claims.
Yeah.
But I promise you this is a weapon.
It really is. It's a diagnostic instrument for your brain.
And that is our mission for this deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't just exploring some abstract theory. We want to hand you a tool. By the end of this conversation, we want you to be able to look at any comparison or analogy, whether it comes from a politician or a salesman or your own internal monologue, and pin it to a specific tier on this scale.
You'll know exactly how much weight that claim can actually hold. We're going to move from the very bottom, which is just, I have a feeling, all the way up to the absolute peak, which is these two things are mathematically identical.
And we're going to see that there are very specific rules for every single step of that climb. But before we get into the nuts and bolts of the tiers, we have to talk about the origin story of this framework. Because the way this document came to be is actually kind of weird, isn't it?
It is super unique. It's a great example of what we call independent convergence.
Let's set the scene for that. So the author of this framework, and we'll just refer to them as the author, they didn't start by sitting in a library reading 1,000 books on cognitive science or philosophy.
Right. They weren't trying to write a book report on existing theories.
They were reasoning from first principles. They were literally just trying to solve a structural problem about how we make claims.
They were effectively working in a clean room. They built this whole architecture from scratch, just trying to make the internal logic work.
And then, and this is what the literature review actually covers, they went back after building the model and check their work against the absolute giants of the field.
Heavy hitters. We're talking about Dedre Gentner in cognitive science, Nelson Goodman in philosophy, Douglas Hofstadter.
So unpack that for us. Why does it matter that they did it backward? Why is independent convergence so significant here?
Well, think about it this way. If you read a textbook and summarize it, you've proven you can read. That's good scholarship, sure, but it's derivative. But imagine you are an explorer. You sit in a room and you map out a completely new continent in your mind based purely on logic and ocean currents.
Okay.
And then you actually sail there and you find out that the map you drew from scratch matches the actual coastline exactly.
That gives you a completely different level of confidence in the map.
Exactly. It suggests robustness. It implies that the structure they found isn't just an invention of their own mind. It suggests the structure is actually there. It's a real feature of the intellectual landscape.
It's like two people doing a massive math problem in separate rooms and getting the exact same answer. It proves the math is solid.
Right. And what's wild is that, according to this review, the author didn't just match the existing maps. In some places, they connected maps that usually don't ever touch.
Which is the massive value add here.
Yeah.
Usually academia is incredibly siloed. You have cognitive scientists over in one building talking about how the brain maps structure. That's their whole job.
Yep.
And then way over on the other side of campus, you have philosophers arguing about the metaphysics of identity and being. They don't usually have lunch together.
They speak totally different languages, but this framework forces them onto a single page. It basically says, hey, you guys are actually talking about different points on the exact same line.
So let's look at the neighborhood. If we were drawing a map of ideas, where does the hierarchy of relational claims actually live? Who are the neighbors?
It sits right at a really busy intersection. First, you have the cognitive science of analogy. And the big name here is Deirdre Jentner. She is the giant of structure mapping theory.
Which we are definitely going to spend some time on.
Oh, we have to. She basically argued that a good analogy isn't about objects sharing attributes. Like, it's not about both of these things are red. It's about objects sharing relationships. It's about the underlying structure, not the paint job.
Okay, so that's one neighbor, structure mapping.
Then you have the philosophy of similarity. Nelson Goodman is the key figure there. He's the skeptic. He's kind of the guy at the party who ruins your fun.
Right. He basically said, saying two things are similar is completely meaningless unless you specify exactly how they are similar.
The terms of engagement, so to speak. And then you have someone like Douglas Hofstadter, who wrote Gödel Escherbach. His view is that analogy isn't just a fun tool we use sometimes to explain things. It is the core of all cognition.
He argues you can't even look at a cloud and say, that's a cloud, without making a rapid analogy to every other cloud you've ever seen in your life.
Exactly. So the hierarchy is sitting right in the middle of these giants, but it makes a very bold claim right out of the gate. It proposes something called the unified epistemic axis.
The unified epistemic axis. Let's break that down, because traditionally we tend to think of analogy and identity as two completely different buckets.
Right. Bucket A is things that are like each other. Bucket B is things that literally are the exact same thing.
Right. In one bucket, you have poetry and metaphor and loose comparisons. And in the other, you have hard logic and math and strict definitions.
Apples and oranges. But the hierarchy says bring the buckets. It is all one line. It is a single continuous spectrum.
A single spectrum from analogy to identity.
Yes. Think of it as a sliding scale of constraint. Down at the bottom, you have loose impressions, very few constraints. As you move up the line, the constraints get tighter and tighter.
Okay.
And identity two things being the same is simply the point at the very top of the line where the correspondence becomes so tight that there are 0 degrees of freedom left.
That is a really elegant way to visualize it. So Identity isn't a fundamentally different kind of thing. It's just the limit case of analogy.
Precisely. It's like the difference between water and ice. They look different, they act different, but it's really just a question of temperature. Here it's a question of constraint. And while some earlier philosophers like Mario Bunge or Marcin Schroeder have hinted at this idea, the hierarchy actually builds a working architecture around it.
It treats identity as an epistemic question.
Epistemic, exactly.
And epistemic just means related to knowledge, right? Like, how do we know what we know?
Right. It asks, how strong is the claim I am making right now, and can I actually justify it? It forces us to evaluate a random hunch and a proven scientific fact using the exact same set of tools.
It forces honesty.
Yeah.
You can't just magically jump from, hey, these look alike, to these are fundamentally the same. No. You have to climb the ladder rung by rung.
And it is a steep climb.
So let's start climbing. We're going to go through the tiers starting at the very bottom. Tier one. This is called correspondence of impression.
Or as you called it earlier, the vibe check.
The vibe check. I feel like these are similar. Give us an example of a classic tier one claim.
This song reminds me of a rainy day. Ugh. Or your management style is kind of like jazz. Or even this user interface design feels very 1990s.
Okay, I hear that and I nod. It feels intuitive to me. It communicates a mood. But the expert review brings in Nelson Goodman here to just rain all over our parade. What is the actual problem with tier one?
The problem is that it is epistemically empty. Goodman's critique, his seven strictures on similarity, is frankly devastating. He points out that any two objects in the entire universe share an infinite number of properties.
Infinite. Come on, that seems like an exaggeration.
It really isn't. Let's do a thought experiment right now. Take a tennis ball, and let's say the concept of democracy.
Okay, a fuzzy yellow ball and a complex system of government. Go.
Both way less than the moon. Both exist in the year 2026. Both are not made of purple cheese. Both can be discussed using the English language. Both are smaller than the sun.
Okay, I see exactly where you're going with this.
I could literally go on forever. You can list infinite similarities between any two things, no matter how unrelated they seem. So simply saying X is like Y without specifying the dimension of comparison tells you absolutely nothing.
It's zero information content because you haven't filtered the signal from the noise at all.
Exactly. It's what cognitive scientists call the bag of properties problem. If you just have a giant bag of random traits, you can always rummage around and find a match. So tier one is the absolute weakest form of claim.
It's where we start. It's the spark of intuition, but we really can't stay there.
Right. It's a starting gun, not a finish line. If you stop at tier one, you haven't actually said anything substantive yet. You've basically just cleared your throat.
So how do we fix it? How do we filter the noise? We move up to tier two, correspondence of structure.
Now we are getting into the meat of it. This connects directly back to Deirdre Gentner's work. She talks about the systematicity principle. It basically means that really strong analogies map interconnected systems, not just isolated traits. To get to tier two, you have to specify the structure. You stop saying this is like that, and you start saying the relationship between A and B in this system is identical to the relationship between X and Y in that system.
So instead of saying something vague like an atom is like the solar system,
you say just as the gravity of the sun holds the planets in orbit, the electromagnetic force of the nucleus holds the electrons in orbit, now you are actually mapping a structure. You are mapping the forces and the specific relationships.
It's almost like a geometry problem. You're taking one shape and overlaying it onto another to see if the internal lines match up.
Exactly. And that gives us structural coherence. Does the map actually fit the territory? But here's a truly fascinating nuance that the hierarchy introduces. What is a tier two claim actually good for in practice?
Yeah, if it's just a structural map, does it prove anything is true?
The review calls this the positive epistemic function of tier two, or the suspension of negation.
Suspension of negation. That sounds like a shield in a sci-fi movie.
It functions exactly like one. Imagine you are an entrepreneur and you are pitching a wild new business model. A skeptical investor comes along and says, "That's impossible. You can't combine hyper-customized service with rock-bottom costs. Those two things are contradictory."
Okay, that's a very common objection.
If you can show a tier two structural match, if you can say, look at IKEA. They combine high design with low cost by shifting the actual assembly labor onto the customer. We are doing the exact same structural move, but with software.
You haven't proven you're going to be a billionaire.
No, you haven't proven success.
Uh-huh.
But you have proven that the model is logically possible. You have completely blocked the skeptic who says it can't be done. You've suspended the negation.
That is incredibly valuable. It's a defensive move.
It is. It perfectly aligns with what Mary Hess called the neutral analogy. It holds the door open. It says, hey, we don't know if this is the ultimate truth yet, but the geometry fits, so we have license to keep investigating.
It keeps the conversation alive. You can't just rule it out on a whim.
Exactly. But, and this is the big flashing red warning label here, it does not prove necessity. Just because the key happens to fit the lock doesn't mean it's the only key that works or that the lock was specifically designed for it.
And that brings us to the single most important boundary line in the entire framework. This is where I think the hierarchy really shows its teeth. The jump from tier two to tier three.
This is the absolute crux of the entire argument. If you take one concept away from this deep dive, let it be this distinction right here.
Tier three is correspondence of constraint.
Constraint.
So explain the difference clearly. We have structure at tier two and constraint at tier three.
Tier two says it fits. Tier three says it must be this way.
Must. That is a very strong word.
It is a modal claim. It asserts absolute necessity. Tier three argues that the similarity you're seeing isn't just a happy coincidence or a neat geometrical pattern. It argues that there is a governing constraint, a physical law, a rigid rule, and environmental pressure that explicitly forced this outcome to happen.
The source material uses a really compelling example here from biology to illustrate this, Simon Conway Morris and convergent evolution.
Yes, the camera eye. This is the gold standard for explaining what a tier three claim actually is.
Let's talk about the octopus.
Let's talk about the octopus. So humans are vertebrates. Octopuses are cephalopods. Our evolutionary lineages split hundreds of millions of years ago. We are fundamentally extremely different organisms. We have bones, they have a beak, we have hair, they have color-changing camouflage skin.
Right, we aren't close cousins at all. We are distant strangers on the evolutionary tree.
But if you take an octopus eye and a human eye and put them side by side, structurally, they are shockingly similar. They both have a lens. They both have an aperture of the pupil that opens and closes to let light in. They both have a retina at the back to catch the image.
Now, someone at tier one would just say, wow, vibes. They look the same. Maybe ancient aliens planted us both.
And someone at tier two would say, look at the structural mapping. The lens focuses light in both. The retina receives light in both. The internal geometry matches perfectly. It's a highly valid analogy.
But the tier three claim goes a massive step further.
The tier three claim asks why. Is it just a cool coincidence? No. It is because of the physics of light.
The unbending laws of the universe.
Right. If you want to build a machine, whether you are building it out of biological flesh or out of metal and glass that resolves high-definition images from variable-distance light sources, you are operating inside a very specific constraint space.
You literally don't have a choice in how you build it.
You don't. You need something to focus the scattered light that has to be a lens. You need a surface to catch the focused light that has to be a retina. You need a way to control the volume of light entering so it doesn't wash out that has to be an iris. The strict physics of light basically bullied evolution into coming up with the exact same architectural solution twice.
The problem made them the same. That is tier three. It's not just that they happen to map onto each other nicely. It's that the constraints of the problem domain forced that specific structural solution.
That is a massive epistemic distinction. It's the difference between finding a neat pattern and discovering a governing law.
And the hierarchy introduces another subtle but super vital distinction right here. The difference between a narrative correspondence and a constraint-entailed correspondence.
Right, let's break that down because it trips people up. Narrative versus constraint-entailed. When you make a rich analogy, you usually find a lot of parallels. Let's stick with our eye example. Maybe the octopus eye and the human eye both happen to have a brown iris in a specific sample you're looking at. Or maybe they are roughly the exact same diameter.
Okay. Yeah.
Those traits might be narrative correspondences. They fit the story. They happen to be true on both sides of the comparison. But did the foundational physics of light force the eye to be brown?
No.
Oh.
It could easily have been blue or green or yellow. The color doesn't affect the physics of the focal point.
Exactly. The color is purely incidental. It's narrative decoration. But the lens is constraint entailed. You can mathematically derive the absolute need for a lens directly from the problem statement of focusing light. You cannot derive a brown iris from that problem statement.
So to hit tier three, to make that claim of necessity, do you need every single element of the comparison to be constraint entailed? Do you need to prove the whole object was forced to be exactly like that?
No. And that is a crucial rule in the framework. To hit tier three, you only need one single element to be constraint entailed. If you can prove that even one core part of the mapping is actively forced by the laws of the system, you have successfully moved out of the realm of coincidence and into the realm of necessity.
That seems almost lenient, though, doesn't it? Just one forced element gets you to tier three.
Well, think about how incredibly hard it is to prove true necessity. To prove that any possible solution to a problem must invariably take a certain form. That is an incredibly high bar to clear. If you can clear it, even once you have established that you are dealing with a genuine governing constraint, the other parts around it can just be narrative decoration, and that's totally fine. But you need that one solid anchor of necessity.
This brings up the whole concept of falsifiability, which the review gets into. We hear this a lot in the philosophy of science, Karl Popper, and the idea that for a theory to be scientific, you have to be able to prove it wrong.
Right. Falsification.
The review points out that you actually can't really falsify a tier two claim. Why is that?
Because a tier two claim never actually promised you it had to be that way. If I say, hey, this cloud structure looks exactly like a dragon, and you come back and say, but a dragon has hard scales and that cloud is made of fluffy water vapor, I can just say, yeah, I know, the outline shape matches. I never claimed it was literally a biological dragon.
You can't catch them in a lie because they never claimed it was the necessary truth.
Exactly. Tier two claims coherence. It claims a temporary useful mapping. It's slippery by design. But tier three sticks its neck out. Tier three says, because of the physics of light, any high resolution eye anywhere in the universe must have a focusing mechanism.
And that is a claim you can attack.
You can absolutely attack it. You can scour the ocean floor trying to find a complex organism that sees perfectly well in high definition without any kind of focusing mechanism. And if you find one, you have falsified the claim. The tier three claim collapses back down to tier two.
This directly connects to Imre Lakatos, right? His philosophy regarding research programs.
It does. Lakatos talked about the hard core of a scientific research program, the central foundational beliefs that you can't easily abandon without throwing away the whole theory. Tier three claims act exactly like that hard core. To successfully challenge them, you have to engage with the constraints themselves. You have to prove that the underlying laws don't actually force the result that people think they do.
So if a pundit makes a tier three claim, like they say, this new startup will definitively fail because it violates the unbending laws of unit economics, exactly like Webvan did in the dot-com crash. They are saying the failure is structurally necessary.
Yes, they are. And if that startup somehow succeeds, their claim is totally falsified. Their understanding of the constraints was wrong. But if they had just stayed at tier two and said, this startup's warehouse structure feels remarkably like Webvan, and the startup succeeds, well, they can just shrug and say, it was still a highly accurate structural comparison. They just managed to get lucky on execution.
I really love this. It's a way to actually hold people accountable for the words coming out of their mouths. Are you telling me a useful story at tier two, or are you declaring a universal law at tier three?
Precisely. And the hierarchy says, loudly stop confusing the two. It's intellectual malpractice to dress up a tier two observation as a tier three guarantee.
Okay, so we have climbed up from vibes at tier one to structure at tier two to constraint at tier three. And I think most people, most analysts even, would stop right there. They'd say, we found a law of nature, we proved necessity, we're done.
But we are not done. We still have the absolute summit of the mountain to climb.
We have to talk about identity, tiers four and five.
This is where the framework makes a major shift. It gets normative. It stops just describing how we think and starts aggressively telling you what you should do methodologically.
So what exactly are tiers four and five? Let's define them.
These tiers rely heavily on a famous distinction made by the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, the distinction between type and token.
Break that down for us, type and token.
So tier four is identity of definition, or type identity. Imagine you go to a factory and you see two identical Toyota Camrys rolling off the assembly line right next to each other.
Okay, two red Camrys, brand new, perfect condition.
They are obviously not the exact same physical object. They occupy different space. If I take a key and scratch the door of one, the other one doesn't magically get a scratch. They are distinct. But they are the exact same type. They share an identity of definition. Every single engineering specification, every bolt, every line of code in the dashboard is identical.
That's tier four, identity of definition.
That's tier four. Now, tier five is identity of referent, or token identity. That is when we are talking about this one specific unique car. There is only one of it in the entire universe.
So if I make a comparison and say, you know, Clark Kent is remarkably like Superman.
That's the catch right there. That is not an analogy at all. That is a tier five identity. Clark Kent is Superman. They are the exact same individual. They are the same token, just wearing different clothes.
And here is the major normative rule that the hierarchy drops on us regarding these top tiers. It says you are methodologically deficient if you stop your analysis at tier three without actively checking for tiers four and five.
This is a huge twist. The framework says you cannot just blindly assume two things are different and start comparing them. You have a methodological duty to check if they are actually the exact same thing first.
Why is that so crucial, though? Why is it called a deficiency if you don't?
Because if two things are actually identical, treating them as merely analogous is a massive category error. It's a fundamental failure of understanding. You are essentially seeing double. You're treating one thing as two.
Give us a classic example of where we mess this up. How do we see double?
The most famous philosophical example is the morning star and the evening star.
Take us back to ancient astronomy.
So the ancients looked up and saw an incredibly bright star in the morning sky. They named it Phosphorus. And they saw a similarly bright star in the evening sky. They named it Hesperus. For a very long time, they thought they were tracking two completely different celestial bodies.
Okay, makes sense based on what they could see.
You could have built a massive, incredibly detailed tier two analogy between them. You could have said, wow, look, Phosphorus is almost exactly as bright as Hesperus. And look, their movements along the ecliptic plane are structurally perfectly similar.
You could write entire ancient treatises on the beautiful relationship between the two stars.
And you would be completely wasting your time. Because eventually astronomy advanced and we realized they are both just the planet Venus.
You shouldn't have been comparing them at all. You should have been equating them.
Exactly. The multiplicity collapses. That is the exact phrase the author uses. The multiplicity collapses into a single identity. The framework dictates that you must run a test for that collapse. It's not that identity will always happen. Most of the time it won't. A human eye and an octopus eye are definitely not the exact same token object.
Right.
But you have to run the test. You have to ask the question.
And the expert review points out an important caveat here. It says this is strictly an epistemic test, not a metaphysical one. Now, that sounds like a very $10 philosophical distinction. What does that actually mean in plain English for us using the tool?
It means we aren't asking if two things are fundamentally one with the universe in some deep spiritual metaphysical sense. We are asking a practical operational question. Under the specific constraints of the problem we are trying to solve right now, do we treat these as one single variable or do we treat them as two?
Under the constraints, that is the key phrase.
Mm-hmm.
The context of the problem matters.
Right. Context is everything for identity. Go back to our Toyota Camrys. If we are an engineer trying to calculate the structural load limit on a suspension bridge, a red Camry and a blue Camry are two completely different things. That's a tier five difference. We count them as two distinct weights on the bridge.
Correct. You need to know there are two cars.
But what if we are an executive at Toyota calculating the average fleet fuel efficiency for that model year? In that specific context, those two cars might be treated as perfectly identical instances of the same model. That's a Tier 4 identity. For the math we are doing, we treat them as one unified data point.
So identity actually depends on the resolution of your analysis. It's not a fixed property of the universe, it's a property of your framework.
Exactly. And this brings us to a really brilliant meta point the review makes near the end. The hierarchy is recursive.
Recursive, like circles within circles. Mm. How does a framework apply to itself?
You can apply the hierarchy to the very definitions you use to climate. Specifically, when we define a type for a Tier 4 identity, that definition isn't just handed down from on high. It's something we construct.
Right, because if I define my type broadly enough, literally everything in the universe is identical.
Yeah.
I could say we are all just carbon-based life forms, so a human and a mushroom share a Tier 4 identity.
Exactly. If your resolution is set way too low, everything blurs together and looks the same. If it's set impossibly high, every single subatomic particle looks completely unique, and you can't group anything together. The hierarchy uses concepts from the philosopher Luciano Floridi, specifically his idea of levels of abstraction. It says that you have to consciously choose the exact right resolution for the specific problem at hand.
So you use the hierarchy to check if your definitions are sitting at the right level of abstraction. And then once you lock those in, you use those definitions to check your claims on the hierarchy.
It acts as a self-correcting system. It demands that you be highly explicit about your definitions. You cannot just be intellectually lazy with your terms and hope no one notices.
This is honestly so rigorous. It really strips away all the lazy, foggy thinking we usually apply to comparisons.
It's an incredible tool for intellectual honesty. It forces you to show your work at every single level.
Let's do a quick recap of the journey, because we have covered a massive amount of conceptual ground here. It's a ladder. And I want to make sure everyone listening has the rungs clearly marked in their head before we wrap up.
Let's do the lightning round.
We started at the bottom. Tier one, the vibe. I feel like these are vaguely similar.
Epistemically empty. The bag of properties. It's a perfectly fine place to start your thinking, but a terrible place to finish your argument.
Then we move up to tier two. Structure. The map fits the territory.
It demonstrates structural coherence. It proves possibility through the suspension of negation. It blocks the skeptic, but it does not prove necessity. It remains a heuristic, a guide.
Then the massive jump up to tier three, constraint. The problem forced this exact solution.
The camera eye, the law of nature. This is where we finally get falsifiable claims. This is where you can say something had to happen this way.
And finally, the summit, tiers four and five, identity. Are these actually the exact same thing?
The required completion test. The vital check against making a category error and seeing double.
It's a clear ladder. And honestly, once you see the ladder, you really can't unsee it. It's going to ruin a lot of op-eds for me.
It completely changes how you listen to arguments. You stop listening to just the words and you start listening for the structural tier they're operating on.
That was the huge aha moment for me reading this. It gives us a precise, shared vocabulary to diagnose why we are disagreeing with someone.
Yes. Think about how often two smart people just endlessly argue past each other without getting anywhere.
Give us a specific example of how applying this hierarchy fixes a broken argument.
Okay, imagine a fierce debate about history or politics. Person A gets up and says, "The current geopolitical situation we're in is exactly like the Cold War." What they're really doing is making a tier two claim. They see structural parallels. Two massive power blocks, proxy conflicts, simmering nuclear tension.
Okay, the internal map fits the current territory. It's a valid tier two observation.
But then person B jumps in completely furious and screams, "That's ridiculous. The global economic intertwining is completely different today. The internet exists. The underlying ideology isn't the same at all. It is not the Cold War."
Person B is violently attacking the claim as if it were a tier three or even a tier four claim.
Exactly. Person B is saying the governing constraints aren't mathematically identical, so it's not the exact same thing. Well, person A is just sitting there saying, "I never said it was identical. I said the structure helps us heuristically understand the current tension."
They aren't actually arguing about facts. They are arguing about which tier of the hierarchy they're standing on.
Precisely. If they both had this framework, person A could just calmly say, "Listen, I am offering a tier two structural mapping purely for heuristic purposes to guide our thinking. And person B could say, okay, accepted, that's a useful map. But we must be very careful not to let this drift into a tier three predictive claim because the foundational constraints have shifted.
And suddenly, just like that, it's a highly productive analytical conversation instead of a pointless shouting match.
That is the ultimate promise of the hierarchy right there. It clarifies the exact epistemic status of the claim. It magically turns "you're completely wrong" into "let's calibrate what level we are talking about."
Now, we can't let you go without addressing the remaining mystery. The source material ends on a bit of a philosophical cliffhanger.
It does. The author openly acknowledges a very deep, unresolved challenge at the heart of all this.
What is the deepest unresolved challenge of the hierarchy?
It centers entirely around Tier 3. We confidently said that Tier 3 depends on a governing constraint. The physics of light forced the eye structure.
Right. We felt very confident making that claim earlier.
But how do we rigorously, permanently prove that? How do we prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the constraint is genuinely a governing law of nature and not just a very convincing narrative story we tell ourselves after the fact to make sense of the data?
Oh. Because we can't exactly rerun the entire history of evolution to check our work.
We can't strictly prove the metaphysics. The review notes that this is a notoriously hard problem shared with the philosophy of the laws of nature. How do you definitively distinguish a universal law from a mere regularity that just happens to always happen in our local cosmic neighborhood?
It's the classic correlation is not causation problem. Just put on absolute steroids.
It really is. The hierarchy points to counterfactuals as the best functional solution we have. You have to ask the counterfactual question. If we change variable X, would outcome Y still invariably happen?
Like, would the octopus eye still look exactly like that if the physics of light behaved more like the physics of sound?
Exactly. And if the answer to the counterfactual is no, then you can be reasonably sure the constraint is genuinely governing. But ultimately, the review admits, this is a hard, unavoidable philosophical limit. We cannot step outside the universe to check the master rulebook. We can't run the simulation twice to isolate the variables perfectly.
So the framework is an incredible tool for intellectual honesty, but it's not a magical crystal ball that solves the universe.
Right? It maps exactly what we know and exactly what we don't know. It forcefully stops us from claiming absolute necessity when all we really have is structural coherence. And honestly, in a modern world full of viral hot takes and wildly overconfident predictions, that distinction alone is worth its weight in gold.
I think that is the perfect place to land today. It's not about knowing everything perfectly. It's about knowing exactly how we know what we think we know.
Beautifully put.
So here is our final challenge to you, the listener. And this is something to really mull over. Think about artificial intelligence. We have these massive language models now that are basically the ultimate tier one and tier two pattern matchers. They find structural correlations across billions of data points. But they don't actually understand physical constraints. They don't live in the real world. So what happens when we start treating AI's incredibly coherent tier two structural maps as if they were tier three guarantees about how reality works? Are we just building a machine that automates category errors at a global scale?
Gosh, that is a terrifying and fascinating thought. If the machine doesn't know the difference between a narrative and a constraint, we are in for a very wild ride.
Something to keep you up at night. So the next time you hear an analogy, whether it's from an AI in a boardroom on the news or just chatting with a friend, pause.
Don't just vibe with it.
Ask yourself, is this just a tier one vibe? Is it a tier two structure? Or are they actually claiming a tier three constraint?
And if they are claiming tier three demand that they show you the necessity, ask them what exact law forces that outcome.
Don't ever let them get away with a neat narrative when they owe you a hard constraint.
Keep them honest.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We will catch you on the next one.